Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today we welcome an author, a commentator and broadcaster whose work has taken him all over the world, to Beijing, Hong Kong, Manila, Delhi, Colombo. His global perspective and insight into the inner workings of geopolitics is shown in his writing, from the threat of global nuclear war, secret agents in Moscow, and the growing influence in China. He also writes wonderful thrillers. Humphrey Hawksley, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's start right at the beginning, because you grew up in Suffolk.
Yes, and I still go there a lot. In fact, I go there to write my books in Suffolk. And I grew up around Bury St Edmunds and then Saxmundham, sort of inland and then on the coast. And for the past 10 or 15 years, I do most of my writing on the coast, just north of a town called Aldeburgh, which people know for its music festival from Benjamin Britten. But more recently, the bookshop there, John and Mary James, started up a sort of literary festival, and then there's a documentary festival. So it's become quite a sort of gathering place. But from the place that I have, which is a lovely place right on the sea, if you're looking out to the sea and you look left, you see Sizewell Nuclear Power Station. It's a big sort of dome there. And then if you look right, on a clear day, you see the masts sticking out from Orford Ness. And that was the early warning signs in the 60s from if the Soviet Union was going to launch a nuclear attack on us. And we were told then that you had 90 seconds or something to sort of get undercover. Not that that would do anything. But I think, you know, that patch of Britain was then being guarded by these masts that stick up there. Of course, they're not used anymore, and it's now owned by the National Trust. But it was a very secret nuclear Cold War establishment.
And to have both of these within sight is extraordinary.
I know, it's weird. So if you're writing a sort of, you know, international thriller or something, you sort of walk out and say, what to do? Well, you've got that there and that there, and it all sort of comes in together a bit. And as a child growing up, I remember Sizewell A, I think it was called, the first one, was being built there. And we went around it. We went around the building site. I mean, I can't remember how that happened as a sort of school kid. And now, of course, they're talking about Sizewell C, and there's all sorts of protests and that sort of thing going on. And actually, there was a time a few years back that something dropped through the letterbox, and they were handing out potassium tablets for anybody who lived within a mile or 2 miles radius of Sizewell. God knows why, but there was a tent just outside the station where people were queuing up to get potassium tablets, which apparently sort of lessen radiation impacts if there's a leak. I can't remember what it was about, but there must have been some sort of nuclear scare or just keep them in your medicine in case something goes wrong.
This I'm going to call it fixation, that's probably too strong a word, on international travel started very early, because you actually joined the Merchant Navy.
Yes. I guess I didn't know then, or do we ever know why we do things when we're 17 years old? But now I think it must have been in my DNA. And I, you know, when you fill in these forms, go to university and everything, I couldn't quite see what, why, an extension of school or something. So I got with a schoolmate, actually, we got a job on a merchant ship, an iron ore carrier, that went from Port Talbot in Wales to Angola and then round up to Japan. And it dropped us at a place called Hay Point in Australia, which was in the middle of nowhere. I think probably still is in the middle of nowhere. It was a coal mine up in northern Queensland. And we worked around in Australia. In those days, you could just go in and they stamp your passport and you could get a job. So that was it, really. It hasn't stopped.
How did you make that transition then into journalism?
I came back, so I was away that stage. I came back when I was about 20, I think, and got a job on, it must have been the worst job I've ever had in my life. It was down in Colliers Wood, which is sort of right in South London. It paid me, I think it was paying less than £1,000 a year back then. The winter of discontent was happening. And it was a company called Benn Brothers, which I think had some link to Tony Benn, the politician. But I was working on something called Gifts Magazine. So I sat there in this office in the middle of this dreadful part of London, or I thought it was at that stage, writing press releases about onyx ashtrays and that sort of thing. And And something in my, I said, just stick with it. Just stick with it and things will happen. And they actually had another magazine called Printing World that I moved on to. And one of the editors on that got me a job up with a local newspaper near Manchester called the Congleton Chronicle. And then that in those days was the path towards getting onto Fleet Street.
They still
call it
Fleet
Street, don't they?
Mm? I think they do, even though there are no newspapers.
Yeah, there's nothing there at all. Is there?
Who did you work for on Fleet Street?
Fleet Street, there was a place called the Fleet Street News Agency, which was run by a sort of very wide boy character. And he would send us out to do the stories that the tabloids wouldn't do. So if there was a murder or something, we had to somehow get into the flat and get the photographs of the victims and all that sort of thing. We had to do the stakeouts that would last. I remember once I walked in, the news editor said, she said, "Humphrey, how's your bladder?" And I said, well, you know, I'd never really thought about it much. You've got to stand outside. It was this place near here, actually, where Jeremy Thorpe's lawyer was during that trial. You stand outside there until you see him walk in the door, and then you file the copy that he's walked in to see his lawyer. I was there 13 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Until I got relieved. It was that sort of job, but it was great because it got you into, you know, all of the main newspapers and that. You got into it, but they didn't pay anything. And you had to have a car. That was the condition for having. You had to have a car. And you had to get to the story first. So I had this car that I couldn't afford to run, so it had bald tires on it. And then to get to the story first, I had a stack of parking tickets, which they wouldn't pay either. You know, that was a, and I suddenly looked, I said, I can't continue living like this. So I had a friend that I'd met through a story I did that ran a horse transport company of Irish racehorses. And he said, well, you know, if you want to go to Australia, you can train to be a horse trainer and we'll get you on the flights to Australia. I said, well, it's got to be better than this. So I did that and we flew, I don't know, with your horses, you fly backwards. So instead of going sort of to Dubai and Sydney or whatever it is, you fly via Canada because they don't get so much jet lag. And so we flew to Sydney for nothing and I helped look after the horses. And I got in touch with a newspaper there called the Melbourne Herald, which was like the equivalent of the Evening Standard. And I write in with my CV and everything, and the guy just rings up and says, Humphrey, yeah, it's really good to hear from you coming from Fleet Street. I'm sorry, we can't really offer you much because we don't know you, but do you want to start on Monday? And he named the salary. It was four times what I was getting in London.
Wow.
And I rented myself a beautiful apartment in the most fashionable part of Melbourne and haven't looked back.
What a wonderful story. Yes. Why then would you join the BBC and come back to Britain?
that's a good question. And that was a wonderful job, but there was something, that whole thing that I didn't fill in that university form that I thought, well, you know, Australia's good, but I really need to get to Asia or something. So I was a year there and then I went to Hong Kong where I did the Hong Kong South China Morning Post papers. I think I was about two or three years in Hong Kong and then I was about to get on the plane to go back to Australia and something said, no, it's a smaller sea there. I really need to go back to my, you know, my family's in London. So I came back and started shifting on the mail and this and the BBC as well. And the BBC shifts just lasted. And then they took me on as a sub-editor in the Radio 4 newsroom, which again was one of the most mind-destroying jobs I've had if you're that low down, because you've got to, you know, they give you something to write the cues, you know, the cues to the piece that the newsreader goes, like two or three sentences, and you had 3 hours to write it in. So I just got, you know, given the sort of stuff I was doing. But again, I said, stick with it. And I did. And actually, you know, BBC's a great organisation. Yeah.
And you went on to have a very illustrious career there. Tell us what you did for the corporation.
Well, from there, it was a sort of maze. And it even was when I went off staff there a few years back. I still didn't know how anything worked or where the money was or who was making decisions. I don't think anybody does. It just sort of keeps producing really quite good stuff. But I went from that job... I took a job on local radio in order to get broadcasting experience, get the microphone experience, then came back and got a job over in Bush House, which was really where my soul was. When you hear all those languages, in those days it was Bush House and there was a sort of lift that you went up and you'd have the Caribbean over there and Spanish here and Russian there, the World Service, yes, and everything like that. And I was in the newsroom there. And from there, I got a what they call a sponsored stringer's job, where they paid your fare and accommodation, everything, but you still got paid by the piece. And I got to Sri Lanka when the civil war was just starting. And then it just kept going since then.
You were actually expelled from Sri Lanka.
I was thrown out in a very strange way. It was the beginning of the Tamil civil war there that only ended in 2009, and it was just starting. And in those days, the Tamils were the good guys, or, you know, the way you see things, you know, there's the oppressor and the oppressed. They were the oppressed. And the Sinhalese, or the government soldiers, would go into a village and sort of massacre women, children, and anybody who got in their way. And I kept reporting that stuff. And I started getting death threats in the hotel I was staying at. And then they just didn't renew my visa. So I was about to go out on a story, and there were the police and two immigration guys in the foyer of the hotel saying, "I'm sorry, Mr. Hawkes, we have to take you to the airport now." They were very polite and diffident, but you're here illegally. And I said, "Yes, but I'm about to see the Indian High Commissioner." Now, India was like the colonial boss of Sri Lanka in those days, and that sort of set the cat among the pigeons. And I said, "That's for dinner, and then tomorrow I've got lunch with the British High Commissioner." So they all went into a huddle. And they came back and they said, "Well, if you can leave the day after tomorrow, that would be fine." And I said, "But the seats are all booked up on the plane." They said, "Don't worry about that. We'll get you a seat on the plane." So that was how it unfolded. There was no sort of handcuffs or anything that.
But, you were in the Balkans in the 90s. And in fact, you were arrested in Serbia too.
Yes, that was a sort of... it was an interesting thing. I mean, the arrest, again, it wasn't the thing, but... just to imagine, and we're actually getting a lot of it in Britain now, aren't we? So, you know, just imagine that Britain's sort of divided up. So you're used to going from here to Birmingham along the M6, but actually some separatist group is cutting it off in Oxford or something like that. So we were in a car chit-chatting as we were going to a place. We were in Montenegro, actually, which is where that section of the Kosovo War was being, you were able to go. And we were driving up, say, from London to Birmingham, just chit-chatting away, and the driver had forgotten that this section of the road, they should have gone down a little country lane to go past. And then suddenly this guy comes out with their guns and everything and sort of locks us. And they were the Serbian police. And we sort of go, uh-oh, you know, we'd taken our eye off the ball. We were taken to the, I can't remember the name of the town now, we were taken to the town, put in this thing. And it was quite interesting in that we were wondering whether to call, you know, the British Embassy or something. And all our instincts said no, because I'd had a situation with the British Embassy in the Philippines. And I thought, no, that's just going to make it worse. Let our local fixers, who happened to be two very vivacious, intelligent, young Montenegrin women, let them work on the Serbian police. And we'll just sit and do nothing for 7 hours or 8 hours or whatever it was in this room, this fan going around like out of a sort of, you know, Graham Greene novel, and sort of there was a Pirelli calendar girl on the wall, and then there was a torn thing, and there was a nationalist Serbian symbol here, there, and everything, and there was the other room had, it was the armory, so there was sort of rifles being sort of cocked and checked and all the rest of it. They would come in from time to time and say, "Right, you have to tell us that you admit you were spies, otherwise you're going to go to Belgrade and automatically to prison." And we just said, "Well, we refer you to our local producers, say they'll handle it." And then at the end of it, they just said, "Okay, you can go." And we went.
Dear, oh dear. There were all of these big moments like that. You set up the BBC TV Bureau in China.
Yes, that was more of a... less of an adventure, more of a sort of bureaucratic labyrinth to get around. But quite interesting. They had there was a time that the BBC had done some documentaries about Mao Zedong and how bad he was at that time, and the BBC was basically banned. And my task was to not just get a visa to go in and report, but also to get a television bureau and television camera in. And I was in Hong Kong going backwards and forwards trying to get this sorted out, and being China, it was blocked here, blocked there, blocked there. And then there was a Chinese New Year banquet to which the vice foreign minister was coming, and I thought, okay, this is how it'll work. So he was coming in with his entourage of people behind, and there was about 1,000 people there in this huge place. And he was shaking hands. So he shook hands with me, and I said, Vice Foreign Minister, it is all right, of course, isn't it, if my cameraman comes up to record the success of China? And he, probably not knowing what I said, said, yes, of course, make sure it happens, will you? And this sort of got back through the things. And being China, you know, it was probably a bit of a face thing, a bit of a this thing. We did get a visa for a cameraman to come in for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and that just extended. And I think they saw the sense of having television crews in there. But I think we were about the first. I think Reuters might have been in there, but it wasn't a general sort of thing to have it. Now, of course, everybody's in there.
Yeah. Well, of course, what it does mean is that you know China extremely well. And in fact, one of your books is being republished soon. It's called Asian Waters, The Struggle Over the South China Sea and the Strategy of Chinese Expansion. That is published by Overlook Press. Absolutely fascinating topic and one that's moving so quickly at the moment.
Well, that's why I've had to update it, practically rewrite it. And we're republishing it like 18 months after it came out, because the version that was there focused on the China building islands in international waters in the South China Sea. And it's quite a technical thing, but what they've done is they've taken this area of the South China Sea, which is a sort of main Asian waterway, and trillions of dollars of trade goes backwards and forwards there every year. 12% of Britain's trade is reliant on those waterways going in and out of there. And they've taken islands or rocks. And when I say rocks, I mean basically the size of this table we're looking at, you know, poking out of the water. And they've reclaimed land, and they've built at least 5 fully fledged military bases on them, where you can land aircraft, dock ships, launch missiles and all that sort of thing. So now any vessel going through that waterway, it's like going through a sort of strait where you've got Chinese guns, radar and that on you. And then they haven't done anything to stop that trade. It wouldn't be in their interests, but they control the straits. And then from that, you think, OK, so what else is China going to do if this is allowed to happen? Because it breaks all international law and nobody's fired a shot to stop it and all the rest of it. So I began looking into, OK, so which countries are they trying to control and that? And I got to the stage where I looked at Europe and I thought, oh, my goodness. You know, we had here Hinkley Point. At one time, George Osborne, the former chancellor, was saying he wanted Chinese money to build the controversial HS2. I think that they were invited to do Heathrow and that sort of thing. It's as if the whole of Europe was seeing China as this bottomless pit of money, but not what it actually was, which was an expanding, rising autocratic power, which operated on a completely different set of values to us. The updated version of that is taking into account everything that sort of happened in a way since Donald Trump got in, because he tended to change, you know, he tends to change the landscape of things. But we've now had, you know, we've had the Huawei decision in Britain, whereby we're allowing it in, but that's caused a ruction with the United States. The United States isn't having it. The European Union issued a statement about a year ago saying that China was a systemic rival, advocating an alternative form of government to the values of the European Union. There's a number of other countries that have sort of basically said they don't want any more Chinese money because of all this. And now we've got the Hong Kong riots. That problem hasn't been sorted. We've got 1 million people in detention in Xinjiang. That's that Muslim area up in the northwest, which is a sort of separate cultural area where the Chinese government is trying to sort of turn them into good Chinese communists and that. And you've got the trade war, and now you've got the coronavirus. So you think, if you're sitting up in Beijing, they have this place called Zhongnanhai, which is a bit like Downing Street or the White House, and that's where everybody sort of gathers to make decisions. If you're sitting there seeing all this stuff come across your desk, you wonder if you've pushed too far too fast and what eventually is going to happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Your new book will tell all. That, of course, is not your only nonfiction. You also wrote Democracy Kills, What's So Good About Having the Vote. What is so good about having the vote? I would have thought it was essential. You disagree.
No, I asked the question. I love it that if you ask a question, people immediately think that you've got a viewpoint. That was a post-Iraq book, actually. It came out a few years back, and it was quite controversial, particularly as for the question that you just asked. Yeah. It was identified as me being somebody who was against democracy. The argument in the book is you cannot export the democracy that you and I enjoy here into Iraq and expect this panoply of great things to come down from the heavens, you know, like a fair judiciary, a non-corrupt police force, a non-secular military, and a Tesco's and all the rest of it. You know, we worked very hard to get this. And actually, when with the Brexit stuff going on over the past few years, there's been a reflection of that a bit in that, you know, trying to reverse the vote and all that sort of stuff. But that came out. And then after that, you had the Arab Spring, whereby you technically had an overthrow of dictators in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, and almost in Syria. None of that worked. None of it worked. So the title of Democracy Kills is, yeah, democracy is great, but you've got to know how it can work properly. Otherwise, people are going to die. And one thing that I get angry about, and I won't try and portray it too much on your show, but is that after Iraq failed, we then went ahead, when I say we, Britain went ahead, and overthrew the dictator in Libya. And Libya is now the cause or the transit point for the refugee crisis that's flowing into Europe. And that has got all that immigration problems and issues and the politicization, the rise of the right and all that. So these knock-on effects have been quite enormous.
Your thriller writing, though, is very much informed by all of this knowledge of geopolitics, isn't it? I mean, they're contemporary and they're set against a great background of politics and conflict.
Yes, I've started a new series. They now call it a series. I think this is because of the Netflix and Amazon stuff, is that you have to you have a character. So during the Ukraine crisis, 2014-2015, I sort of looked at the map and I thought, where is a place that can reflect what is happening in Ukraine but not be with the pack there? And this is essentially a Russia against Europe and America issue. So I looked at that old Times Atlas that I still have. I looked out there. I looked at the US-Russia border, which I had never looked at before. And I thought, right, these two superpowers have got a huge, massive border. And there are two islands there, one Russian and one American, that are barely 2 miles apart. And I don't know how many of your listeners might remember Sarah Palin as vice presidential candidate got herself into hot water when she said Americans can see Russia from their backyard. And she was completely and utterly sort of digitized over it. And I listened to that interview. She's absolutely right, because I went to that island and there are 80 Eskimos. They call themselves Eskimos, a Native American Inuit Eskimos live there. And it's a sort of rock like that. And their houses crawl up the hill, and you get up in the morning, you open them, and you see a Russian military base on the other side. And if you have a pair of binoculars, you can see the watchtowers under which they're looking at America. I did a piece for the BBC on it, and it was quite interesting. It was almost as if these two superpowers deliberately want to keep this border quiet. All the other stuff is in Europe, but there it's quiet. And I thought, well, I've got to start a thriller there. So the hero of my thriller series, a man called Ray Kazena, actually comes from that island, which has got me into a bit of hot water in a way, in that I keep him going, but we always have to keep sort of referring back to this remote island in the Bering Strait on the US-Russian border.
Now, before that, you'd written a number of standalone thrillers. What's the advantage of having a character that goes through several books?
I think the commercial advantage is that if somebody picks up Ray Kazena book 4, which hasn't been written, and reads it for the first time and likes it, they will then do 1, 2, and 3. Mm. So if you look at this, the author statistics, there's the author recognition and character recognition are the two sort of big draws. If you have a standalone, firstly, you could have author recognition on that, but you don't have character recognition. And as a writer, you have to create in your own mind a different batch of credible characters each time. Mm. Interestingly, I did a book called Security Breach in 2007 or 8, where both the agent and the publisher told me to make it a standalone. But that was before. So, you know, this must be how the market works. Mm. It's very difficult. But now that Netflix and Amazon and Disney and all these people do these series, people are thinking that they want to get into characters, they want to get into locations, they want to get into a familiar atmosphere of an hour-long sort of Netflix series as opposed to seeing a movie. So that's something, and I think that's reflecting back into the publishing trade, certainly the commercial fiction publishing trade that I'm involved in, the thriller publishing trade.
So the first in the series was Man on Ice, but there's another.
There's another called Man on Edge. And I think, I'm not sure why we call it Man. I think it was because Man on Ice is sort of double entendre, is that, you know, he's actually making a trek across the ice as part of the adventure, but it's also mankind on ice. And the other one is Man on Edge, which is mankind on edge as well. And we had the US-Russian border for Man on Ice. Edge, we go on the NATO-Norwegian-Russian border. So in a way, I sort of bookended those two sides of Russia. Same characters. There are same sort of four characters that are very big, because Rake has a on-off fiancé girlfriend who they sort of, they're very good together in conflict zones, but they're not so good together when it comes to the suburban life and the white picket fence and that sort of thing. Pinning that, I'd put the politics, the same sort of politics that went into Democracy Kills, that went into Asian Waters, sort of underpins these, what these characters are up against. So I did a lot of research into what Russia is doing in the Arctic. And as that ice melts, there are now a much more commercial shipping in the summer is going through the Arctic. So to get a ship from Shanghai to Rotterdam or something, by 2030 or 2050, people are thinking, or the experts think, you could pretty much have a reliable leaving Shanghai at such and such a time, arriving in Rotterdam at such and such a time. So what Russia is doing with the help of China is building the technology that can make that work for them. So China's Costco line is pioneering a sort of ice-breaking cargo freighter. Russia owns much of that coastline and is putting in military bases to protect it, a little bit like what China's doing in the South China Sea. It's making claims to international territory to make sure that it's got control of that whole thing. It recently said that pilots, these are these navigators that go on board a ship when it's going into port, only Russian pilots can be on the ships going through the Arctic. And over in the States, the people, the politicians in Congress that sort of look at this are tearing their hair out because nobody's taking any notice. So Vladimir Putin has said the Arctic is Russia's future and is spending billions on militarizing it and the rest of it. China's spending billions on technology and getting the trade routes sorted out there. And the Americans have got, they don't even have a deep water port up in Alaska. I mean, they just have Coast Guard ships and visiting ships. And this is becoming a huge controversy in Washington.
I wish we could delve into the meat of the books, which are very thrilling, very exciting and unexpected. And with such a kind of well-grounded knowledge of everything that goes on behind. But we've run out of time.
Have we really? That was quick.
Humphrey, thank you so much. So the publisher of those two books, Man on Edge and Man on Ice, is Seven House. Overlock Press does your non-fiction, and I hope that you'll be back to talk to us about that in the future.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie German. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.